Dead On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I won't say that we've got superhuman powers here on the horn, but we are among the smartest folks on the radio, terrestrial, internet, or standing on the porch and screaming into a dented tomato can attached to a piece of kite string. It don't get any smarter than what we got going on here. There's Mark Levine referencing Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and a little bit later, something that... Come on, I dare you. When was the last time Flush Flimball mentioned Heisenberg's uncertainty principle? How about Hannity? How about O'Reilly? How about Savage? How about never? Huh? Yeah. We got the smart folks here, and that's mighty cool, because you know what? Smart is a turn-on.
I like long walks on the beach. And people who aren't mean, and people who are smart.
Yeah, exactly. Just like the pullout at the right. Yeah, on the centerfold, the little playmate data sheet. You betcha. Huh. Well, you know what? I'm not going to start this evening. Let me say this. In addition to smart folks on the network, and smart listeners to the network, and smart callers, and smart bloggers, and smart chatters, and smart emailers, we're also kind of prescient. Last night, it was said that Senators Clinton and Obama need to be told to go to their rooms and not come out until they can act like civilized people. And lo and behold, today they both issued, little press releases in which they said, you know, we are disturbed by the tenor that this campaign is taking. And they've decided to play nice. Because they realized the truth of something that I said last night, and that is that they were running the risk of profound voter turnoff. And as a consequence, that they were running a risk of handing some primaries to John Edwards sort of by default. So they decided to come out and say they would play nice. Now it remains to be seen whether or not they will follow up on that promise. So, yay you. Yay us. Ahead of the curve again. We're so far ahead of the curve that the people behind us think they're driving on straight road. Now, whither to start tonight? How about another incidence of that? It was shortly after Thanksgiving, which I guess was the 21st, 22nd, something like that, of November. When we came back the following Monday, I did about an hour, maybe two, I can't remember, on the wholly, utterly, undeniably, feloniously corrupt status of the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals. And I'm going to bring it a little close to home this evening and to tell you about it. And bless your hearts, several of you sent me this story. And I really, really do appreciate it. It's great to see that folks outside of West Virginia are paying attention to West Virginia issues, because when that begins to happen with some degree of regularity, and, you know, you're not doing it just because, you know, old Bob lives there, you're beginning to realize that there is a little bit of a microcosm down here in the hills and hollers of the Appalachian Mountains, and that what happens here does matter outside our borders, because there are a lot of states out there that would be sitting in the dark right now were it not for West Virginia and her people and her mineral riches. But it was the Monday after Thanksgiving, I do believe, if not no later than the Tuesday after Thanksgiving, that I told you about all of this stuff with the West Virginia Supreme Court. So let's see, that's November to December, December. So, you know, every bit of almost 2 months ahead of the curve here, but the stuff has hit the fan for one of our corrupt, dirty, bought-off, nasty Supreme Court justices, a person who holds himself out to be a Democrat, but is in fact just a horse's ass named Spike Maynard. Old Spikey has been found to be, shall we say, rubbing elbows with folks he ought notta. And the folks he ought notta would be the guy that we have frequently referred to, among other epithets, as Don Blankenstein, Don Freakenstein, Don Blankenswine. In other words, the CEO of Massey Energy, Don Blankenship, who gets paid millions of dollars every year to lose money for his corporation. His corporation, of course, Massey Energy, being one of the primary criminal enterprises engaged in the destruction of the oldest mountain range on Earth via mountaintop removal. So, this has made it all the way to the New York Times. And it matters. Because whether it's coal here or some other topic, some other resource in some other state, do not think that this kind of behavior is isolated or limited to us hillbillies here in the mountains. In the summer months, folks in West Virginia like to go to places like Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. Those are the folks who like to stay in the mountains and stay in the green and go and put their tents or their RVs by a babbling stream, maybe dip a line in a water, pull the hat brim down over their eyes, take a little nap by the song of the stream, because, you know, we can't do that here so much anymore because, well, so many of them our streams have been destroyed. But they go to places like Pigeon Forge. Those who don't want to listen to babbling brooks instead might prefer the susurrations of the seashore. And they go to places like Myrtle Beach. They save all year to get away for a week to go to Myrtle and to run up and down the beach and, you know, the charm of the little teenage romances that bloom during that week-long vacation and all of that stuff. You know, it's straight out of the Dirty Dancing. You know, nobody puts baby in a corner. Yeah, okay, sure. God, I loathe that movie. But while working West Virginians are doing that, Spike Maynard, West Virginia Supreme Court Justice, Spike Maynard doesn't like to take his vacations with the plebeians. He doesn't like to take his vacations where the common folk go. No, he wants to go somewhere special. So, Spike Maynard goes to the Principality of Monaco on the French Riviera. And it just so happened in July 2006, a complete coincidence, who could have thunk it, that Spike is kicking back, having a tall glass of something or another, wearing a shirt, according to the photograph I'm looking at, that's somewhere between coral and, I don't know, salmon, or perhaps tangerine, maybe sherbet. I'll rely on the more the fashionistically inclined to straighten me out on that. Wearing his little shirt on a balcony overlooking the French Riviera, when what to his wondering eyes should appear but his lifelong bosom buddy, Don Blankenswein. That's right. Complete coincidence. There was no planning. Absolutely no way that this was anything but an example of the sort of random chance that right-wingers reject when they say that this planet was intelligently designed. Nope, that's just chance, just random. There's Spike. He's one West Virginian partying in the Principality of Monaco. And there's Don Blankenship, another West Virginian who just happens to be, just wink, wink, nudge, nudge, happens to be partying in the Principality of Monaco on the French Riviera, 5 or 6 thousand miles from the hills and hollers of West Virginia. It's a complete coincidence. And so were the women they were hanging out with. I think coincidence is another, it's like some sort of Monacan word or something for the profession that's kind of old, but never mind. And so there they are. There they are. Spike Maynard, West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals Justice, and Don Blankenstein, Blankenswein, Blankenship, living the high life on a balcony overlooking the French Riviera with the mountains of, I don't know what, Provence in the background. A matter of complete and chaotic random chance. Equally random was the fact that Spike Maynard on this West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals had been sitting in judgment of various and sundry appellate motions brought before that court by lawyers for none other than Don Blankenship, Blankenswein, Blankenstein, Blankenfreak, whatever. A complete coincidence. It was also coincidental that Justice Maynard had ruled the way Don Blankenship wanted on each and every occasion. Complete random chance. You know, the whole thing, if you sit there and you flip a penny and you flip a penny, sometimes it's going to come up heads and sometimes it's going to come up tails. And statistics say that it'll come up roughly an even number. There's an even number of opportunities, even number of chances that it'll come up either way. But sometimes it comes up with Don Blankenstein's head on it and there's a check in the mail. Or you wind up in Monaco. Who knew? Who knew? I mean, this couldn't possibly have been planned. Really, I mean, what kind of conspiracy theorists are we that we think something like this could possibly have been planned? So there it is. It's July 2006. And looking at us through the lens of the cameras, Don Blankenship and Spike Maynard, each of them sitting there grinning like a fox eating shit out of a wire brush. Because, baby, the fix is in. Oh, Jesus, the fix is in. $75 million judgment. CEO of the company the judgment's entered against. Living the high life. Man, he ain't got a worry in the world. Because the guy he's sitting next to is going to fix it. And the fix came in on November the 20th, 2007. Roughly 16 months after that idyllic weekend. These sons of bitches can't even stay in the United States for the birthday of the nation. Did you just notice that? I just noticed that. They leave America for the 4th of July. Wow. Just wow. So 16 months after these photographs are taken, Spike Maynard joins in an opinion, which if you go and read it, and you may not be one for reading legal opinions, and I wouldn't blame you, because reading legal opinions is like, I don't know, it's like poking your face with a darning needle, insofar as it feels so doggone good when you stop. But if you were to read this opinion, you would find it was some of the most pathetic, twisted legal reasoning that has ever been applied to paper. I mean, the kind of reasoning that not even a first-year law student, but an undergraduate senior in college, hell, maybe an undergrad, maybe a senior in high school could look at it and go, "This is garbage. This is crap. Who wrote this? Send it back." But there it was on November the 20th, 2007. Everything that Don Blankenship could ever have dreamt of, and more. Giveaway of giveaways. Gone the $50 million judgment against Massey Energy. Gone the $25 million or so in interest that have accrued on that judgment since it was entered by a court of competent jurisdiction, being the Circuit Court of Boone County, West Virginia. Gone. Just gone. You know, like a UFO over the horizon. Where'd it go? Oh, it was never here. What judgment? Just gone. That's all. But it's the tip of the iceberg. It's the tip of the iceberg. This is one of those moments when one is inclined to look back to the statement of Willie Stark, as penned by Robert Penn Warren in All the King's Men, in which he tells his dirt digger, Jack Burden, "There's always something. From the stink of the Didy to the stench of the grave, man is born in sin and dieth in corruption. There is always something." And it's not even something you have to dig that hard to find. Spike Maynard, dirty. Brent Benjamin, dirty. Robin Davis, dirty. And I'm sitting here wondering if I'm boring you to death with this, or if this has the... frankly, if I tell the story right, just by telling you what the facts are, this thing has all the sick twists and turns of a novel like, you know, The Firm or The Pelican Brief. This is sick and sleazy to the point of crying out for a wholesale house cleaning. Spike Maynard needs to be impeached by the House of Delegates of West Virginia. Brent Benjamin needs to be impeached by the House of Delegates of the state of West Virginia. And Robin Davis needs to be impeached by the House of Delegates of the state of West Virginia. Immediately. Now. Yesterday. Because you see, there, and I'll explain with regard to each one why. But you need to also understand that there are canons of judicial ethics. I know, judicial ethics. It sounds like a contradiction in terms, and has been made more so by the shenanigans of the Supreme Court of Appeals of the United States. But still, they're there, and they can and should be applied. And principal among those canons of judicial ethics is the assertion, the statement, and it's not precatory, it is hortatory. It is shall language, not may language. A judge shall avoid the appearance of impropriety. Note the language, as the right wing was fond of reminding us over and over and over and over again during the Clinton administration, words mean things. A judge shall avoid the appearance of impropriety. Not a judge shall avoid impropriety. You know, that's the judge shall, you know, that's like a judge shall not go drunk driving up and down the roads and, you know, wiping out school buses full of children and creating fireballs of death and destruction. No, no. Shall avoid the, even the appearance of impropriety. Some have called it the Caesar's wife standard. Because concepts of equal justice under law are so absolutely, positively central to the concept of a free people engaged in self-governance, the rule exists that says that those whom we allow to sit in judgment of us shall not even be permitted the appearance of wrongdoing, the appearance of impropriety, not the appearance of illegality. It's a higher standard. This is the appearance of impropriety, improperness. You understand what that? I'm sure you do. I don't like it when I say, do you understand? Because I've got one of the smartest listening audiences on planet Earth. I guess it's a rhetorical device. But you get what it means. What it means is that when you go to NewYorkTimes.com and you search Motion Ties West Virginia Justice to Coal Executive, and you see that photograph of the guy in the coral salmon leisure shirt grinning and yucking it up with the guy with the pencil-thin mustache, and they're both sitting there looking like foxes eating shit out of a wire brush, grinning that way, what you're looking at is the appearance of impropriety. The very textbook definition of it. Now, for anybody who ever thought that I was just some sort of partisan flack, I want to reiterate, the guy in the salmon, coral, whatever shirt is a Democrat. He comes from McDowell County, maybe? Mingo County, West Virginia? I can't remember. But he is a Democrat. And he needs to be removed from office. And anybody in the West Virginia House of Delegates who says, well, I can't do that to a fellow Democrat, needs to leave with him. This is deadly serious business. We're in an election year, and in another couple of months, we will be plastered in this state with yet another survey from the United States Chamber of Commerce telling us that West Virginia is a judicial hellhole because we make it impossible for business corporations to do business. This is what makes it impossible to have any faith in a judicial system. Spike Maynard is a piece of crap. So is Don Blankenship. And those two snuggling up together on the French Riviera is nothing but the appearance of impropriety, especially when a year or so later Spike does the bidding of Blankenship and erases a $75 million court judgment that was duly had, tried and true by a jury who returned the verdict that said Massey Energy engaged in illegal activities geared specifically to destroy another coal company. The other coal company wasn't exactly, you know, small potatoes. There's a lot of money involved here. So how on earth is an ordinary West Virginian to think that they can have anything approaching justice out of a bought and paid for slug like Spike Maynard? Remember, a judge shall avoid the appearance of impropriety. These two have been seen dining together in Charleston, West Virginia, in Logan, West Virginia. They hobnob together. They run around together. They have a high old time together. Hell, they're pals. You know what? If you want to be pals with him, Spike, you need to get off the court because you're creating the appearance, my friend, of impropriety. And you are thereby violating the law. He must be removed from the bench. So too does the bought and paid for creature who also sits on the Supreme Court by the name of Brent Benjamin. A pale, doughy, bought and paid for little animal that Blankenship put on the Supreme Court specifically to overturn the judgment against Massey. Oh, it's dirty, and it goes mighty, mighty deep. You see, unlike the Supreme Court of the United States, where Chief Justice is an official position, the Chief Justiceship of the West Virginia Supreme Court rotates on an annual basis. A man was the Supreme Court justice who was due to be Chief Justice for this year was a fellow by the name of Joe Albright. Good man. Good man. And Joe Albright, well, his primary problem was that he was not a sufficient suck to Don Blankenship, and not a sufficient suck to other members of the court. So the vote that was taken in November of 2007 it was a pro forma vote. It goes in rotation. Last year it was you, next year it's going to be you, and this year it's going to be me. It just goes in rotation. But lo and behold, they had their little vote in November of 2007, and guess what? Brent Benjamin became Chief Justice for the 2008 calendar year, skipping over Justice Albright. Why do you reckon? Why? Tell you why. There are a series of cases coming before the Supreme Court called the Roane County gas cases. Roane County, West Virginia, Calhoun County, West Virginia, Wirt County, West Virginia, Jackson County, West Virginia, and Wood County, West Virginia are all, and you may not know this, filthy rich in natural gas reserves. They sit smack dab on something called the Big Engine Reserve. And it's been pumping out natural gas for over 100 years now. And there is a fortune to be had there. Now, bear in mind also that Calhoun, Roane, and Wirt counties are three of the most abjectly poverty-stricken counties in West Virginia as well. As is often the case with the extraction industry, being it gas, coal, oil, whatever, wherever that stuff is, the people, by and large, the folks who scrabble out a living every day, are, without fail, the poorest. But there is, you know, there's gold in them our hills. And there is a series of cases called the Roane County natural gas cases that are coming down to the West Virginia Supreme Court. It is a huge judgment. It is a monstrous judgment. It is a horse-gaggingly large judgment. Big like, you know, sort of like the Massey verdict that got erased. The only thing is, they don't want that verdict erased. West Virginia Supreme Court Justice Robin Davis especially doesn't want that verdict erased because that verdict is held by a lawyer by the name of Scott Siegel, who just happens to be Robin Davis's hubby. Robin Davis, you know, she can't pull a Brent Benjamin and refuse to recuse herself, and she can't do what Spike Maynard did and refuse to recuse himself, despite having hobnobbed, you know, in the Kingdom of Monaco with one of the litigants in the cases, you know, Blankenship. No, no, she's got to recuse herself. There's just no getting around it. And she will, if she hasn't already. Some of this may already be history. I haven't checked the status yet lately. But what had to happen is, if Joe Albright had been Chief Justice, Joe Albright would have had the power to appoint the replacement justice to sit in vacation for the recused Robin Davis. All right, you with me so far? And if Joe Albright picked the judge, Joe Albright is not bought and paid for, and Joe Albright could not be counted on to pick a guy who would vote the right way and make sure that the verdict, the multi-million-dollar verdict, was upheld. On the other hand, because Robin Davis had written the majority opinion, she took that monkey off, you know, when Brent Benjamin said, "Father, let this cup pass by me," on writing the opinion on the Blankenship-Massey case, it did. And it also passed by Spike Maynard. In other words, Blankenship's two cronies couldn't dirty their hands that obviously by writing the opinion, so the task fell to Robin Davis, who wrote the opinion and then voted with Spike Maynard and with Brent Benjamin to skip Joe Albright as Chief Justice for the coming year, putting Brent Benjamin in as Chief Justice, who would then have the power to pick the right guy, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, to uphold the Roan County gas case's verdict. Do you see how it all sort of... Oh, what's that Eastern philosophy sort of general, the interconnectedness of all things, do you see it? Because that's what we're dealing with here. Spike Maynard is dirty, Brent Benjamin is dirty, and Robin Davis is dirty. And, you know, it's one thing to say that a mobster is dirty. It's one thing to say that a gangbanger is dirty. It's one thing to say that, that a politician is dirty. But when you are at a point where you have to say that a majority of your Supreme Court in your state is dirty, well, you know, last one out, turn off the lights, you know what I mean? Now, I don't know if there are enough people in the House of Delegates of the state of West Virginia, which has, you know, which is engaged and is sitting now and is in session, to open impeachment hearings against these three. But I'm going to see, I'm going to make the phone calls and see if, you know, get a little bit of a groundswell started, I hope. Because if we don't, we're done. We're licked. We're whipped. It's over. Really? And this doesn't just impact the guy on the other side of the Massey case, and it doesn't just impact Robin Davis's husband. The utter, complete, and total collapse of the justice system in West Virginia affects everyone in this state. And of course, it's not, you know, it's not just here.
Spike Maynard had someone to look up to in his skullduggery with regard to Don Blankenship. You remember the Clinton years when Flynn Ball would say, "What, my friends, what will we tell the children? He's lying about sex. What? And Bill O'Reilly said that more teenagers were engaging in oral sex that was Neil Bortz, because of Bill Clinton. Yeah. Well, Spike Maynard and Brent Benjamin had somebody to look up to as well. They had Justice Antonin Fettoni Scalia, who went out bird hunting with Dick Cheney and hobnobbing with the Vice President of the United States at the very same time that the Vice President of the United States was a party to litigation pending before the Supreme Court of the United States of America. He was asked to recuse himself, and he whipped it out and just peed all over the canons of judicial ethics and said, "Screw you, I'm fixing what needs fixed." So that's where we begin this evening. What do you think? I'm kind of isolated here in the hills. Does this kind of stuff go on where you live? Are your judges dirty? Are your judges filthy, bought and paid for and owned by interests that aren't yours? Is it just me? Am I the only one that this pisses off? Am I the only one disillusioned by this? Am I the only one disgusted by this? Outside West Virginia, does it matter to you that this is happening here? I suggest to you that it should, because, you know, isolated incidents have an ugly habit of turning into trends, and then one of these days it'll be somebody you love in front of that court, and you'll be begging for mercy, not justice, and I'm telling you, you'll get justice and not mercy. Because isolated incidents have become trends, and trends have become law. Right? And certainly, well, I don't know. I don't know if we have anybody in the House of Delegates here in West Virginia with the nerve to even, never mind submitting a resolution or a bill, with the nerve to even whisper that impeachment is the only thing that can clean up and save the judicial system in West Virginia. I don't know. So we'll take a little break. You want to get involved in the program? You know how. 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. 304-658-5453 if you have an unlimited long-distance calling plan. I welcome your thoughts. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. The way I always do. How was I to know? She was with the Russians too. I was gambling in Havana. I took a little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this. Ha! I'm the innocent bystander. Somehow I got stuck between a rock and a hard place, and I'm down on my luck. Yes, I'm down on my luck.
I'm a desperate man. And lawyers, guns, and money. This shit has hit the fan. Guns and money. Send lawyers, guns and money. Send lawyers, guns and money.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Tune in to Night Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Hey. Thanks for lending an ear.
Hello, may I help you?
Hello, can I ask a few questions about the apartment you have on Park Street?
What was your name?
My name is Juan Hernandez.
It's been rented.
Oh, it's gone?
Hello?
Hello, my name is Sanjay Kumar. I am calling about the apartment on Park Street.
It's not available.
It's not available, but I just now saw it in the paper.
May I help you?
Hi, my name is Tyrone Washington. I'm calling about a place to rent on Park Street.
No longer available.
It's not available now.
Nope. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Hello?
Yes, hello. My name is Graham Wellington. I'm calling about the apartment for rent on Park Street. Is that still available?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Oh, really? I'd love to make an appointment.
Housing discrimination is illegal. If you think you've been a victim because of your race, color, national origin, sex, religion, disability, or family status, call 800-669-9777 or visit fairhousinglaw.org. Fair housing. It's not an option. It's the law. Brought to you by HUD, the Ad Council, and LCCREF.
Hey,
So two lawyers are walking down the sidewalk one day, and they see this really beautiful woman walking down the other side of the street. One lawyer looks at the other and goes, "Man, I'd like to screw her." The other lawyer looks at him and says, "Yeah, out of what? I'll be here all week. Don't forget to tip your waitress. Try the veal." You know, I told you last week that I took Agnes across the river so she could show up for her jury duty summons, grand jury duty. And because she has problems that would prevent her from being able to sit there and listen to the misdeeds of poor people, ignorant people, and desperate people for hours on end, she was, in fact, excused from grand jury duty. But while I waited for her to be excused, I got to see the sad and pathetic parade of people into magistrate court, because the circuit court and the magistrate court in Fayette County are all in one building. And as I watched that, it was a shoplifting case, and it was a domestic violence case, and a battery case, and petit larceny, and all the DUI and speeding tickets and all the little things that afflict the poor and the uneducated and the ignorant in our society. Small claims court never seems to quite have the same charm as it did on night court on the TV. And it is a parade of human misery, and there is no better word than petty to describe these claims, be they criminal against individuals or be they civil claims among litigants. Because pettiness rules the day. And what happens when these people get in there, maybe they'll, maybe the woman cops a plea to the shoplifting charge, because her lawyer has told her, "Listen, just plead to it, have done with it, you'll pay a fine and you'll move on." So she does. But after she's entered the plea, the magistrate invariably feels the urge to deliver some sort of lecture, some sort of admonition to the offender about making smart choices and not dumb choices in life, about striving to do the right thing, and, "Honey, maybe you need to be in church." And yet, that kind of lecture is never delivered. Petit larceny in this state is defined as stealing less than something of less than $1,000 value. And it's from, a penny to $1,000. It might be a bottle of Sudafed, things being such as they are, so you can go home and cook you up a mess of meth. And there's always this hypocritical lecture from someone who you know is not without sin and yet somehow is more than willing to cast the first stone because they've been elected to do so, a magistrate. Magistrates in West Virginia are not required to be lawyers or to have a legal education. Magistrates, dig this, magistrates in the state of West Virginia are not even required to have a high school education. Really. And they'll lecture the screw-up on how to get their life right and live a better way. but no such lecture is ever forthcoming for the Don Blankenships of the world. No, no. Don Blankenship, on the anniversary of our nation's birth, hops a jet airliner to the south of France, the French Riviera, and the Principality of Monaco. So, too, does Spike Maynard, Supreme Court Justice of the state of West Virginia. Spike Maynard writes opinions for the Supreme Court of West Virginia, extolling justice and the correct interpretation of the rule of law, and then spits on it. Why would anybody in this state have any faith in the judiciary anymore? And let me extend that query. Why would anybody in this country have any faith in the judiciary anymore when we've had 8 years of Bush nominees, nothing but shameless judicial hacks and flacks to the Supreme Court, the Federal District Court, and the Court of Appeals? Is there anybody out there within the sound of my voice that believes that the concept of justice remains a viable concept in the once great United States of America in the first decade of the 21st century? Is there anyone who believes that? After Bush v. Gore, is there anyone who believes that? Hear the crickets? I don't either. So, your thoughts are welcome on the topic. Would you militate for impeachment proceedings against these West Virginia Supreme Court justices if it was up to you and if it was within your power? Would you write letters to the editor demanding it of your elected representatives? Would you knock on their doors at their offices? Would you phone them? Would you email them? Would you demand a restoration of a competent, honorable judiciary? Or would you just sit back and say, well, you know, reckon that's how it's always been. 7 minutes before the hour, Tuesday evening. And I'm glad to have you along. I've had a couple of calls lately from folks wanting to comment on various and sundry stories. If you are new to the network, let me tell you now, because I'm having been doing this for a while, I make certain assumptions, and it's bad for me to make those assumptions. I make assumptions that people know, whether they're new to the program or not, that they can bust in at any time, and that unlike many talkers on the radio, that I don't mind shifting gears and changing topics at a moment's notice. I don't mind that because that's the nature of conversation, and that is what we are creating here on the Horn, have been creating, continue to create, and that is why we call it Conversation Radio. I know from the ringing phones here in the studio at all hours of the day and night that there are people discovering this programming all the time, and I don't do a good enough job of A, reminding folks of the phone number, 877-443-2366, toll-free, or via an unlimited long-distance dialing plan, 304-658-5453, or of giving out my email address, bob@headonradio.com, or of inviting people to the chat room, headonradionetwork.com, and just sign up for the chat room, jump right in, the conversation's fine. A lot of fun folks in there and a lot of great dialogue. You should do yourself a favor and try out the full multimedia experience of both listening to the program and participating with some of the listeners in the chat room. It's great. The emails start flying back and forth and you are immersed in a complete multimedia experience. So welcome to those of you who are new to the program. to those of you who are new to the program and to those of you who aren't, a gentle reminder that this is, in fact, listener-supported conversation radio, that on roughly $2,000 a month, we produce almost as much live, liberal, progressive radio content as organizations that cost 1,000 times as much per month to do. An amazing band of professionals and volunteers and dedicated people make this network happen. From the moderators in the chat room to the news ninjas who maintain the blog and the website, to the folks behind the scenes who make the computers and the streams go, to the people on the air, all of whom do this for nothing more than love and dedication and determination to see that the idea of dialogue and free speech and debate and discussion in this country does not go down the toilet, does not die, but shall, in the words of Abraham Lincoln, have a new birth of freedom. And I will tell you that we are at the midway point of the month of January, and we are not anywhere near the midway point of our monthly fundraising goal. It just is what it is. I'm sorry. I wish I could tell you that we were. We're trying to pay off some debts, trying to pay off some bills from stuff that had to happen with regard to equipment here. We got to within $1,000 of our goal last month, so we had to, this month's goal is $3,000. We are not to $1,000, and we are halfway through January. That's not a good sign. But as an added incentive, I'll also remind you that Horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner of Rick's Place, that runs on the weekends right after Billy Shear's Night Sounds, has decided to put his money where his mouth is, literally. And Rick has said that for every regular donation toward the monthly goal that comes in, he will match those funds into an effort to build the new studios so that we can start talking about doing video and expanding what the Horn does so well already, so that we can do it even better, develop more talent, develop more programming, and make this bigger and better than anything that anybody out there can imagine. So for every dollar that comes in, Rick Goodner matches it into our effort to buy, you know, prosaic stuff like wire and insulation and sheetrock and mud and tape and electrical boxes and linoleum and ceiling panels and all the stuff that it will take to create a freestanding studio for the Horn. So your contributions to keeping this going really, really do have some added kick this month. And I hope you'll remember that. And I hope that you will help keep this little experiment going. Where to next? Oh, let's segue from the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals into the United States Supreme Court. What do you say? I like the idea. There was a Supreme Court opinion that came out today. And it's not anything earth-shattering like, closing Guantanamo or spying on Americans. No, it's something, in a way, more, it's a business case. It's a business-oriented case. And a lot of people turn away and go, well, you know, I'm not involved in that. It doesn't affect me. Well, yeah, it does. This is a case that has to do with Charter Communications, a cable and internet provider. Investors
sued Charter Communications under a line of Supreme Court cases that permitted such, because they maintained that Charter had actively colluded and conspired with a couple of different companies, one of whom was Scientific Atlanta Company and Motorola, conspired with them to deceive investors and inflate the price of Charter Communications stock. Doesn't sound very sexy, does it? Well, it's not until you realize the degree to which the stockholders got ripped off. It was, of course, a 5-3 ruling. Not a 5-4 ruling, because Justice Breyer, doing the right thing, doing the thing that Antonin Scalia can't bear to do when he's in one of these situations, Justice Breyer disqualified himself from hearing the case because he owns stock in Cisco Systems, which now owns Scientific Atlanta, which was one of the alleged conspirators and colluders. Well, the outlook wasn't rosy for the Mudville Nine today, as the poem goes. By a 5-3 ruling, the Supreme Court of the United States gave free rein to corporations to cheat their own stockholders and to engage in conspiracies in doing so. This ruling today protects, let's see, it protects equipment suppliers, it protects accountants, it protects law firms, and yes, Lord God, yes, it protects banks who do business and engage in collusion and fraud with corporations who are ripping off their shareholders. Like I said, this has to do with Charter Communications, Motorola, and Scientific Atlanta. On the other hand, it also has a great deal to do with other companies, because, you see, there's a similar class action lawsuit banging around out there, instituted by shareholders who were ripped off by, oh, what was his name? He's allegedly dead. He just disappeared. There was no autopsy. He's probably living with Elvis on Mars now or something, or maybe Michigan. I did. Ken Lay, Kenny Boy, Enron. There's an Enron suit that's still out there, in which investors are seeking more than $30 billion from Wall Street investment bankers, many of whom are political contributors in our system. Wait. I know this story. I've seen this movie. I know how it ends. Yeah, trying to get $30 billion out of Wall Street investment banks who schemed and colluded and conspired with Enron to hide that humongous honkin' ripoff. Mouseketeer roll call for the majority. Anthony Kennedy writing the opinion, concurring and voting with Justice Kennedy. Why, yes, it's Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Sammy Alito and Justice Clarence Thomas and Justice Antonin Scalia. Oh, my goodness, the gang's all here. Hail, hail. Dissenting? Justice Souter, Justice Stevens, and Justice Ginsburg. Justice Breyer recused from the case. But 5-3 or 5-4, so what? The thugs, Scalia, Kennedy, Alito, Roberts, Thomas, have told Wall Street investors
that they have no recourse when they are actively ripped off. That's tall stuff. And by the way, you know, we're not talking about the difference between a 29-cent can of green beans and a 39-cent can of green beans, or, you know, the prices being today what they are, a $1.29 can of green beans and a $1.39 can of green beans. No, no, no. Uh-uh. No. Because Charter Communications in this particular case had inflated fraudulently the value of its stock and its revenues, I'm sorry, the value of its revenues, by $17 million. And as Justice Stevens wrote, Charter could not have done so, this is a quote, could not have done so absent the knowingly fraudulent actions of Scientific Atlanta and Motorola Incorporated. Meanwhile, Justice Kennedy said the Securities and Exchange Commission is a protector of investors in similar cases, and that the regulatory agency has used its enforcement power to collect more than $10 billion over the last 5 years. Hoo-ah! Apparently, they missed out on the little conspiracy between Charter Communications, Scientific Atlanta, and Motorola. But, you know, no organization's perfect. Now, are they? No, hell no. Yeah, you're going to miss one now and then. Every now and then, a $30 billion Enron suit's just going to kind of fall through the cracks. Meanwhile, today on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average took another 277-point header. Around the bowl and down the hole. Roll, roll, roll. Yeah. I mean, what are investors supposed to think now? That they can, is it all just... And see, this is a steady march toward the pure so-called free market capitalism that these freaks all yearn and ache for, in which it's absolute caveat emptor. You know, let the buyer beware. But the problem is, no matter how wary the buyer is, they can still be defrauded by inside dealings, and the Supreme Court said today that they can't do a damn thing about it. Ah, you shouldn't have invested your money. You should have kept it in the mattress, dumbass. Here's what happened. Charter got Motorola and Scientific Atlanta to buy advertising with money that Charter provided. Charter provided the funds by paying a $20 premium on each of hundreds of thousands of cable TV set-top boxes. You've seen them. They say Scientific Atlanta on them, or Motorola, for $17 million. And then the overpayments equaled the amount that the two suppliers paid for the ads. Jesus, if a disc jockey got caught doing this, they'd put him in prison for 10 years. It's called payola, baby. But if you do it to the tune of millions, it's just sharp business practices. Right? Yeah. Grab your ankles, American investor. There ain't going to be a lot of loving in this. This is just rape. Let's go to the phones. Hi, who have I got?
Oh, my gosh, it's Michelle.
Oh, my gosh, it's Michelle, yes.
Oh, you sound like I did this morning watching C-SPAN. Oh, my gosh. He got me busting the gut over here. I'm like, oh, wow. Somebody else that talks smack. Do you sit and talk smack to the TV? Or?
Oh, no. I just wander around out in the yard muttering at the heavens, Michelle.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I try doing it inside the house, Agnes just runs me off.
Well, luckily, I only had the cats and the dogs to deal with me yelling. But so you're talking about the rulings in the Supreme Court. I called to talk to you about this whole transportation committee and the FDA and their rulings on cloning, you know, the identification.
Oh, I know. Funny, this pork tastes like just like the pork we had yesterday. Well, that's because it is. Well, not really. It's just a clone. Oh, yeah.
And
this pork tastes like chicken. That's because it's a porkin'.
So what was so ironic is the guy from Des Moines, Iowa, you know, the paper, he says, well, Mr. So-and-so, one of the guys with the FDA, since this is, you know, your industry, you know, since you're a major holder in, or a farmer, and I'm all the time thinking, friggin' cronies. You just look at it.
Yeah.
You know, they're cronies, major cronies. They all look, and this guy steps up, and Bob, this is what he does. Well, you see, you know, and I am just acting it out, but it's all monotone.
Michelle, that's because they hope that people will go to sleep and not notice.
Or someone like me, like there was a lady that kept pushing the questions on, now wait a minute. And when she asked, well, you know, why is it when people are asking, wasn't this mandated? Didn't you have public intercourse, you know? Didn't you have some kind of committee that went out and talked to the public about what your rulings were and where, you know, what's the point of having the FDA if you don't regulate, you know? Well, this guy comes up with his monotone voice, you know, and the whole thing is he looks rational and she looks irrational. Any type of emotion, then, you know, you're discounted as being irrational. But he says, another guy steps up and he says, well, see, the people mandated that. So that's why you have these people out there that have developed organic and are selling organic meat. And I'm like, oh, my God, no. The reason why we have people doing that is because we couldn't get our FDA to do what we pay our taxes for, which comes back to what I was talking to you about transportation and them wanting to put 40 cents per gallon on the American hardworking people when the friggin' corporations are running to Mexico or Puerto Rico. You see where...
Or the Kingdom of Monaco. I mean, you know...
Yeah. Oh, Dubai. And skiing down the mountain... snow skiing down the mountain in the enclosed mountain in Saudi Arabia. You know, I mean, come on.
I know. I've seen that. I've seen that picture. Yeah.
It's just absolutely... to the transportation, Bob, I really called to rant. I really did. The transportation. If they had, in 2001, if they had fought, truly, the Congress, if our Congress, even this last year, if they had fought to get these tax breaks for these corporations off the books, make them start paying taxes. We don't want paying taxes, you know, not having all these little breaks. We wouldn't have, I mean, it started with Reagan, and Clinton didn't work too well on it either. Well, he worked well for the corporations, but, you know, my gosh, just the in debt, and it's all on the back of the working people.
Sure.
And like you said, here with the Supreme Court, they turn to him and say, well, you dumbass, you shouldn't invest it in such a company, huh? You know, I mean...
It's a free market. You were free not to invest, and they were free to rip you off if you did. Isn't freedom great?
Freedom, let freedom reign.
Well, it reminds me of, what is it, Ode to Billy Joe? No. Freedom, well, anyway, the line, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's, no.
No, it's
No, somebody will correct us.
Yeah, I'm not in the chat room.
But that's a very true statement, Michelle, you know. There's nobody freer than somebody who ain't got nothing.
Right.
You're free to starve. You're free to die. You're free to freeze to death in the winter and burn up in the summer. Man, I tell you what, you can't beat that freedom. Boy, I'm in a grim state of mind, aren't I?
Well, here, you know.
Me and Bobby McGee. Thank you, John Fox. Poppy. Yeah, okay. Took me a minute.
I would expect that of him.
Yeah, Ode to Billy Joe was about throwing something off the Tallahatchie Bridge or something. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was with the cops, you know, I think. Yeah, you know, it's like I look out here in California, and I mean, I talk to so many people that just are so ignorant about the tax bracket that they are under, you know. They, you know, and how the poorest people have all these services and don't have to pay taxes. But, you know, just an example, our state tax, California state tax, is 11.7 on the poorest.
Wow.
7.1 on the richest.
You're kidding.
No, exactly.
The income tax?
The state tax.
Yeah, the state income tax.
Uh-huh. Household, yeah.
11.7 on the poor, 7.1 right. on the rich.
Yep. And second,
that's regressive.
Next to lowest. Oh, exactly.
That ought to be unconstitutional.
Oh, Reagan. Oh, I know, but see, If you look at the tax, go to CTJ, and they'll lay it all out for you. It's Citizens for Tax Justice, and they're not extremists. They're not saying, you know, like, what's his name, Paul, whatever, you know, the candidate. They're not just, you know,
get high and cut taxes. Yeah, libertarians, yeah, I know what you mean.
Right, you know, stop paying the government, you know, that. What they do is they lay it out like, you know, I was looking at it this morning because I got motivated. I'm just like, the top 25 tax savings from stock option companies, Microsoft, in the past 3 years, you know, in 2003, they saved $1,376 from tax savings from stock options, you know. So that means they didn't have to pay money because of their options with their stock, I guess, you know. So,
yeah, well, you know, capital gains taxes are...
Right.
Yeah, those are un-American. And windfall profits taxes, those are un-American, too.
Right, and then you have the largest accelerated depreciation tax break, you know, ever. So you go on there, and you look at it. SBC, which is now AT&T, Verizon, ExxonMobil, Wachovia, you know, these... Oh, did you see where Citigroup, is it Citigroup that's not doing so well?
But aren't they the ones that...
They lost it, some billion?
Was it... some Arabian prince in conjunction with the People's Republic of China are investing, I think, in Citigroup. Yeah, because it was Bank of America that bought Countrywide home loans,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. They're all beginning to run together for me. It's
They are. Oh yes. It reminds me.
But no, seriously, 277 point header on you know, just down the toilet today.
Yeah.
On Wall Street.
Yeah.
And the thing is that those things have real consequences ever since a bunch of working people's pensions got thrown into it. We used to have real pensions in this country.
Right.
You know, nobody was going to be rich in their golden years. But theoretically, people who had real pensions were also not going to starve either.
And those companies had to show that they not only had that money set aside, you know, but they had insurance on it.
Yeah.
So that money for those retirement funds, that couldn't just be over there floating around, you know, as letters. It had to be concrete. It had to be there. You know?
Seems like a nice system to me, Michelle. But then, you know, I'm a far left, you know, bomb throwing maniac, I guess.
Tree hugging pinko liberal.
Aren't I disgusting?
Yeah, you just make my skin crawl, man. You know, it's like you really need to just kind of pull yourself up by your straps and the boots and quit bending over.
Yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that. No, this is a roller coaster that America doesn't want to be on. But you know what? This is a roller coaster that America chose to be on. We got stuck with George Bush in 2000, Michelle.
Right.
In 2004, assuming, and that's a big assumption, assuming that there was even anything close to legitimate about the vote count, we chose to go this route. We had a chance to turn things around.
Now, okay. Now, I'll give you a good example to argue against that vote counting thing. Today, a court ruled for Kucinich. Was it today? Right?
Yesterday.
Then, what went in there and did a countersuit appeal on it? The media. A media corporation went in an appeal on what the judge ruled against the ruling for Kucinich.
But yet, now they say, NBC does say that Kucinich will be in the Nevada debate tonight. Of course, the thing's going to be moderated by Brian Williams and Tim Russert. I'll be amazed if Kucinich gets asked one single question.
But what the hell is the media doing going in there? What's their...
Oh, you just asked the million-dollar question, Michelle. What? Why does the media care who's in the debate?
Exactly. You know, I guess because as I'm looking at the total of 25 companies that, you know, get these accelerated taxation depreciation rates, you know, that is... But when you're talking about the vote and we put ourselves here, kind of. But there is so much fraud out there. I mean, I am still, even though I went to the voter register of voters office about my stepdaughter, and she was part of that Orange County where they a whole bunch of people that were getting petitions signed, they also re-registered people.
Mm-hmm.
From Democrat to Republican. I don't know if you, this happened.
I'm familiar with it.
Okay. Well, it happened to my stepdaughter. We went down there. They said, oh, just fill out the forms. Okay. She gets an absentee ballot for, her name's Melody, but she also gets an absentee ballot for Melanie. And Melanie is a Republican.
Really?
So... And I'll tell you, we spoke to the person, and this was all supposed to be changed. That was supposed to be dropped off. Guess what? Still there, 2 years later. So that tells you kind of the whole, I mean, you're right. Now people need to stand up and say, you know, Kucinich should be there. I don't know about this.
I'd like to, frankly, I would like to hear Obama and Hillary and John Edwards say that Kucinich should be there.
Oh, yeah, well, of course.
But see, that's the problem. There's another frame in this discussion about who gets to debate, and I've seen it in writing, and I've heard it spoken that, well, you know, we can't have so many people in the debate because the more people we add to the debate, the less ideas will be discussed.
Oh, yeah, that's why...
Bull!
Britain just doesn't work, does it? You know, that's why Canada just doesn't work. You know, they have to limit how many people are, you know, are representing us, for one thing. Yeah, okay.
But see, that's actually, one, if you go back to the debates that Kucinich was in, you'll find that he certainly didn't take out all the oxygen from the room with all the talking that he did, because he had to practically beg to get a word in edgewise, one. And two, any time that there's a discussion going on, the more ideas that are being presented makes it all the more likely that the correct outcome will be reached. You know, the great American judge, Learned Hand, he was a Native American, and, you know, he said time after time, the remedy is more speech. You don't quell somebody else's speech because you don't like it. You add more speech to counter it.
Right.
But there is a real danger, frankly, to the so-called horse race mentality of this campaign, in that if Dennis Kucinich is there and he gets to say what he has said a couple of times before, i.e., you know, I was right about the Iraq War. I was right about the occupation. I was right about health care from the get-go. I was right about NAFTA. I was talking about NAFTA when nobody else was talking about it. I was talking about GATT and the WTO when nobody else was talking about it. Wouldn't it be nice to have a president who was right the first time out and didn't have to sit here and explain to you why they were wrong the first time? That is what they hate.
Yeah.
Because suddenly, neither Obama nor Clinton nor Edwards looks quite like the wily coyote super genius that they want the electorate to think they are.
I like that analogy. Exactly. Wily coyote. Exactly. Yeah,
so,
it's not entertaining.
And that, you know, that debate starts at 9. I don't have MSNBC anymore, so I won't be watching it.
Can't you watch it on...
online?
Yeah.
Well, no, because that eats up too much bandwidth, and we have programs going on here.
Darn it, John. Oh, no, yeah.
It's not. No. It's the horn section, and it's also, I won't sacrifice. Frankly, there will be more of value said in the programs that happen here on the horn that will be said by anybody short of Dennis Kucinich in the Dog and Pony Show tonight.
Oh, exactly.
And frankly, I'm deadly serious. I don't expect Tim Russert or Brian Williams to ask Dennis Kucinich one damned question, Michelle. Not one. He will have to beg.
Yeah, well, I'll have to put that on in the background.
And by the way, you're being summoned to the chat room.
Oh, see how they are. I didn't go in there because I know how bad I am. All right, well, don't you have other callers?
Well, I do, but I got other callers. I got other stories. I got
other things to do. Damn.
Yeah, but the thing is, every time you call, Michelle, it's 5 minutes before the show ends, and I want to make sure that we have a full and meaningful conversation instead of cutting you off and going, gotta go now.
No, thank you for letting me... bring up those topics, because I really want people to look at what the FDA is doing. I want people to look at that, to be aware of what they're allowing, and do your best to buy from your local if you can. I know that's more expensive sometimes, sometimes these farmers will work with the community, I want people to understand. And then this transportation, oh, God, that just, it just aggravates me I think paying taxes is the right way to take care of your society. But when it's on the back, not only on the back of the American hardworking people, but then you've got these people that were conned into these loans, because of their own ignorance. Or, they wanted to be better on the block, so they ate into their equity, which is totally, the United States capitalism at its best. But the fact is that now, the government can go and take their home. Before, they couldn't take their home. Now they can take their home. So it's all on the...
Thank God for bankruptcy reform.
Yeah, oh, I know. You've talked about that last week, and it's just, so it's things like this that just are, I don't know. And like you said, it's kind of like it's due, but it's not really due. It's just that it's going to take this for people to be, the stock market and these sores, these pains, these aches that are going to come from the actions or the inaction. To wake the American people up. It's sad that that's going to have to happen, but it has to because of, as you say, the laissez-faire, I guess it's Bush again, or also because of the meeting, error meeting.
I know, yeah.
So you just, I just got this clink, 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 5:30 meeting, clink. On my computer. Multitasking at its best.
Hey, that's what we're so good at.
Okay, go get another call.
All right, take care, Michelle. Good to talk to you, dear.
Oh, I love you guys.
We love you, too. Have a great evening.
Oh, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, suddenly I'm sneezing, and I really don't want to subject you guys to that. So if you hear any extended bouts of silence, that's what that is. What kind of allergies are present in mid-January, for the love of God? Something. So, yeah, the one story that Michelle mentioned, you do know, the FDA came out today and said cloned pork is safe for human consumption? Okay. And, you know, I'm not one of these people who's out there banging away hammer and tongs against scientific advancement. I personally would like to have a little cloned Bob heart and a set of Bob lungs and Bob kidneys and Bob liver. You know, spares. I know a photographer whose rule of thumb is if anything that's worth having one of is worth having two of. And I like the idea of having some spare me. Just because I'm that way. But, you know, cloning Arnold Ziffel and then putting him on the plate in front of me, and God knows I'm not one to ever shy away from a plate of, you know, pulled pork or, God knows, a big old slab of ribs. Ooh, Lordy. Oh, I can eat me some ribs. And I make a mean barbecue sauce, I want you to know, a mean one. But cloning, see, this is directly contrary to everything that the march of human progress has been about. Vegetarians, please save your snide comments for later. The very nature of human-animal husbandry over the millennia, literally. I think, we domesticated our first animal something like 10,000 years ago or so. You know, about 4,000 years before the earth was created. And all along, it's been a matter of managing and breeding and, you know, getting better and better and, breeding for this trait but not that trait. And crossing genetic lines until you get to an animal the way that, you know, you want the animal to be. But now, big food science comes along and says that's all wrong. Every animal needs to be the same. Pig 1 needs to look like pig 2, needs to look like pig 3 that looks like pig 4,715. Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that that is not a smart approach to animal husbandry. Because if there are genetic deficiencies, you produce it in pig 1, you replicate it in pig 2, and God only knows what happens when you get down to pig 4,715. Anybody who's ever made a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy on a copy machine knows what happens. Back in the bad old days of analog audio, you went to the store, you bought the album. Then to preserve the album, you made a cassette tape of it. Or going even further back and weirder, you made an 8-track tape of it. But you learned early on that if you copied the album onto the cassette and then you copied the cassette onto another cassette and you dubbed that cassette onto the third cassette and the third onto the fourth, and that eventually it sounded like crap. And it's the same thing with pigs or chickens or geese or sheep. You don't want to shallow the gene pool. You want to damned well deepen it. And, you know, I know that George Bush is opposed to human cloning, and because there, and frankly, because there is a George W. Bush on the planet today, I am opposed to human cloning. One of him is damned well plenty. But wholesale saying, you know, there shall be no... That's never a good idea either. I don't want to eat clone pig, though. And I don't want to drink clone milk. It's bad enough what they do to the cattle to make the milk now as it is. That icky stuff. Oh, ask John Fox. He knows all the... he was talking about it on his show one day and put me off milk for about a month. Honey, what is this? I can't quite tell. It tastes like pork, but it tastes like chicken. Well, honey, that's because it's a chork. It's a chig. It's picking. You know, I don't want to go to dinner on the island of Dr. Moreau. But it would seem that is where the FDA and please let's get square about something here too. This it's not some farmer in Keokuk who's gone to the FDA and said, "Well, clone me a couple of pigs and I want to take them to the slaughter now." And I said, "Okay." It's not some guy with 4 or 5 hogs and a sow with a brace of piglets. It's the Monsantos and the Archer Daniels Midlands. The industrial food grid. I'm sure that they had support from the likes of Smithfield Meats. What is it? 32,000 hogs per day are butchered at the Smithfield plant in Tar Heel, North Carolina. What's it matter to them whether the genetic material is the same as the pig before it and the pig after it, or if the genetic material's different? Pig's a pig's a pig with a, you know, once the butcher knife's going through it. What's it to Smithfield if you see what I'm saying? Because they go for uniformity anyway. They like for their hams to all look the same. They like for the fat back to all have the same size stripe. So you get it. Well, until we get a responsible government, we're going to live behind the eight ball. But more particularly, I have a sneaking suspicion we're going to live on the island of Dr. Moreau. Hi, who have I got?
Susan.
Hey, Susan, what's up?
Well, about the FDA. The FDA also at one point said thalidomide was perfectly safe. We all know how that one turned out.
Yeah, I have a little on my cornflakes every morning.
Yeah.
My genetically modified cornflakes.
Right. The genetically modified thing, that is the reason why, you know, I'm getting ready to buy my seeds and stuff like that for next spring.
Yeah.
I'm not even, the first place I went were to the Heritage websites. I am buying stuff that is certified non-Franken food, non-genetically modified.
I think that's wise. Now,
for no other reason than you can take the seeds off of that crop you put in, save them over the winter, put them in the ground and they'll come up and you'll get the same thing. You can't do that with these hybrids.
No.
Which means you have to keep paying these agri-conglomerates your money for your food, which may not be what you think it is. It could have genes from animals, even though it's a plant. It could have genes from humans.
Sure, was it the potato that Monsanto developed, the Franken-Spud, that has actually an animal gene in it to resist a certain bug or fungus the bug bites the plant and dies because of the genetic modification. Yeah, and corn, and frankly it's scary stuff because it's the front end of plague and famine.
Yeah, and the thing is, if you have access to these heritage seeds and keep saving them every year, and you can do that just as long as you can keep putting in crops. You've broken the link between you and the agribusinesses. And you've broken the link between the possibility of plague and famine.
Yeah. I remember the Iraqi crop law that we tried to ram through, and I don't know, we may have successfully done so, that dictated in the area that first grew, you know, started deliberately growing wheat back when it was just a grass with a seed top. We told Iraqi farmers that they had to get their seed from Monsanto and they had to buy it every year and they couldn't save seed.
Yeah. And, well, even if they saved seed, it wouldn't grow. It's hybrid.
Yeah.
What they get is some weird thing that's, you know, it's like a rose coming up off of the roots. A hybrid tea. If that graft dies, what you got coming up from the roots isn't a tea rose, it's nothing even close.
Well, yeah, that's a grafting issue. Same thing, you know, you can eat a golden delicious apple and save the seed and plant them, and you will not get that apple.
Exactly. But the thing is, in the United States, unlike Europe, you don't have the choice unless the company tells you of being able to tell this is genetically modified. There's no law that says they have to label it.
No.
So, of course,
there's no country.
Nobody would buy it.
And even if there was... See, this is a multi-layered problem, Susan, because even if there was a law that said it had to be labeled, you know, if it's grown in America, it has to be labeled whether it's genetically modified, well, okay, fine, Walmart will just go somewhere and find a farmer to grow it in Kuala Lumpur where they and then not tell you because, you know, we don't have country of origin labeling.
Yeah, we do not have country of origin labeling. We do not have whether or not it has been genetically modified. We don't have either one of those. You can bet your 50 Europe does, and because of that, they can't sell Frankenfood over there. No one will buy it.
Well, you know, like I said, I told a little secret on myself. I snuck away for an hour last night to watch the only TV show that I actually try to sit down and watch every week, and that is No Reservations with Tony Bourdain. And he was in Berlin last night. And my son-in-law looked at me and he said, you know, everything looks so nice, it looks so clean, the food looks so good. Why isn't it like that here? And I said, well, that's because the Germans have a responsible government that's made up of the German people. We don't.
Yeah.
We have a government that's made up of millionaires who don't give a tinker's damn about the people who aren't millionaires.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've had something banging around inside my brain ever since Mark Levine was talking about it earlier this evening, Susan, and that is this idea of liberal versus far left. And, you know, under any conservative's standard, I guess you and me and folks listening to this program qualify as far left. But the more I think about
it, Andy, if that's what I am, I am.
Well, but the thing is, you're not. We're not.
No, I know.
I'm this is not me gooning on Mark because I'm not, but the framing of these things, you know, why am I a leftist? Because leftist is code for communist, of course.
Of course, then again, here's my reply to this. Why does it give any intelligent person, why doesn't that intelligent person give a flying F what they think about you, because they're irrelevant?
Well, but sadly, Susan, they're not irrelevant. They're not irrelevant at all. You've got far right members of the Democratic Party, and I include in that group, the people in Congress who solidly lobby, who basically exist as mouthpieces for the coal lobby, for instance.
And Reid and Pelosi.
Yeah, and the right wing calls them liberals and creates this notion that they're some when they're not. And yet, you know, by the same token, I was talking about this last night, we don't refer to Mike Huckabee as a fundamentalist cleric, which he is.
Yeah.
But I'm a far leftist. And for the life, you know, I'm not advocating overthrow of the government. I'm not advocating revolution. I'm not whistling the Internationale and screaming "Workers of the World Unite!" You have nothing to lose but your chains.
I am screaming this.
I want a responsible, reasonably ethical government that is responsive to the needs of the American people. Those needs include health care. They include protections for people who choose to invest in the stock market. They include meaningful pharmaceutical reform. It includes eliminating legalized bribery in the form of PACs and lobbies for congressmen.
Oh, yeah.
How in the world, and I think this may actually be more important than maybe either you or I or anyone else gives weight to, how in the world have we gotten to the point that asking for a reasonably ethical government that is responsive to the needs not just of a small segment of the population, but to all of the population, how is it that that gets to be termed far left?
I'll tell you how. We stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Well, we stopped that. We stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine. We changed the media ownership rules. And we got defined as far left because we let them define us as far left.
Exactly. And because of that, because we no longer have the ability to bust up these conglomerates, they're going to frame us exactly how they want us.
Well, we've got a lot of trouble then, because, you know, we've got Democratic politicians who run like hell from the label liberal. Oh, I'm not a liberal. I'm a moderate. I'm a moderate. You know, I hate moderates.
I'm a liberal.
And I say I hate moderates because moderates don't stand for anything. They're nothing but a walking ball of compromise.
Well, to me, moderate is the same as a centrist, which is, to me, is the same as roadkill. You're in the middle of the road.
Yeah, but a centrist, Susan. Where the hell's the center? The center's way over on the right. That's what I'm trying to get at. That's why you and I are leftists. That's why we're leftists, because we're actually just middle American with reasonable hopes for our government and for the future. You know, not advocating anything icky or bloody or nasty.
I keep remembering that.
But we're called leftists because the center has been shoved all the way over just to the left of Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, I keep remembering that explanation of liberal that John Kennedy made. And I'll go by that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's something we should pay close attention to, especially as the election season goes on, Susan, because
I'll put myself in John Kennedy's camp.
Sure.
Along with Bobby and Martin Luther King, and that's some really, really good company.
You're forgetting some. I'll gladly put myself in that camp as well as that of Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, Ben Franklin. Nobody could ever accuse them of being conservative.
Quite no. They were all raving liberals.
Yeah. Yeah, they were.
And they were giants. And I think that's the one thing that the neocons and the corporatists in the Democratic Party just cannot tolerate, the thought of running into another one of those giants, because it would make them see exactly how small they really are.
But this, you know, these things have real consequences for America, because it's how you marginalize a John Edwards. It's how you marginalize Dennis Kucinich. Oh, he's far to the left. Yeah, he's angry.
And
well, you know what? If John Edwards,
let's be fair here. How you marginalize Mike Gravel, he is still in there. Yeah.
Well, no, see, I won't mention Mike Gravel anymore because I kind of figured.
I think he's crazy as a sprayed roach. But as long as he's legally in the race, we don't have the right to marginalize him.
Oh, no. That I agree with. But what I'm getting at here is that this business of defining someone, well, you know, they got rid of Dennis with the UFO thing. Honest to God, I think somebody must have given money to Shirley MacLaine to bring out that story because, you know, it certainly wasn't at Dennis's behest. And now they're marginalizing John Edwards. Well, he's angry. Jesus, you know what? What's the old bumper sticker, Susan? If you're not angry, you're not paying attention?
If you're not angry, you're dead.
I mean, who out here besides George W. Bush thinks the economy is puttering right along?
Yeah, I heard today that the, quote, recession is now officially started. I got news for these dudes. It's not a recession. It's a depression.
It may turn out to be one. You know, George was holding hands with King Abdullah out on his ranch. I saw Abdullah's compound described as a ranch today.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it just blew me away. Participating in a traditional Arabian sword dance. You mean they let George Bush around a sword? But he was over there, you know, saying, you know, you need to produce more. We got to have some lower oil prices, you know. And what? Abdullah's, what does he think? Abdullah's as stupid as he is?
Did you hear Abdullah's reply?
We are producing enough oil. This is a function of your weakening dollar. We have nothing to do with this. Your dollar is weak. That is why your fuel is so expensive.
In other words, he told George Bush to go take a flying leap.
Yeah. Here, dance with my sword some more.
Yeah. Be careful of the edge. It's sharp.
Yeah, why don't you shave yourself right about at the Adam's apple, George?
Yeah,
I know.
I kept hoping George would lose his passport and then we could legitimately not let him back in the country.
What are we going to do with you? Susan, have a good evening.
You too. Love to Agnes.
All right. Bye. Yeah, George was, you know, he's spending his, he's having his little out at the King Abdullah Ranch moment. And it's pitiful. It's disgusting. One of the princes of the royal family engaged in a traditional sword dance with George Bush. ABC reports, it was a public and a little awkward display of affection, all part of Bush's first visit to Saudi Arabia aimed at repairing strained relations between the world's biggest oil producer and the world's biggest oil consumer. Apparently, ABC will feature a softball conversation between Terry Moran and George Bush tonight. Oh, that'll be fun. Talking about the Saudis, he says, these are smart people. They know that the price of oil can affect our economy, and they know that if our economy weakens and there's less purchasing power, that it will affect their ability to sell barrels of oil. Shut up, George. We're not going to slow down buying oil. You ever... George, you're a junkie. When you were a Coke boy, if you're not still, you know, when you were cruising along on the Bolivian marching powder, did you ever give a damn whether the eight ball was $250 or $300? Baby, you coughed it up, didn't you, George? Ask a heroin addict how they respond to a rise in prices. They just go out and, you know, knock over another grandma. Mug one extra person a night. Guess what, George? It's the same with the oil thing. And the Saudis aren't afraid of us losing our buying power because, you know what, anything they don't sell to us, the Indians and the Chinese are standing there saying, we'll take it! And, of course, Saudi oil minister Ali Naimi said that that Saudi Arabia would allow market forces. Oh, isn't it just fun when free market capitalism gets turned around sideways and shoved up our bum? Would allow market forces to dictate oil production and prices. We will raise production when the market justifies it. This is our policy. The king has spoken. So then Bush tells Terry Moran, that's why I've got these alternative energy projects going on that I think will make a difference. They don't make a difference in the short term because we're talking about actually beginning to encourage people to change habits, such as using ethanol. And we're also not exploring for oil and gas in our own country like we should be. So! Ethanol. George, when we have planted every last arable plot of land in the United States in ethanol, and there's no more damn place to plant food, what are we going to do then? Well, we can always drink the ethanol. I find I'm not so hungry when I'm loaded. Jesus. Why not? Terry Moran, hard-hitting interview, please. Meanwhile, on the other end of the street, however, it's worth noting that a survey was taken of the Saudi people. You know, while George is out there at the desert ranch of King Abdullah, swapping spit with King Abdullah and holding hands and walking through the sand and so forth, Saudi people, they have a 12% approval rating of George Bush. Only 12% of the Saudi people view George Bush in a positive light. You want some perspective on that? That is less of the Saudi people than view Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in a positive light. And wait, here's the kicker. That is a lower number than the Saudis who hold Osama bin Laden in a positive light. The same Saudi people surveyed think more of Iran, their enemy, think more of Iran than they do the United States of America. Why? Well, among the leading reasons, the Iraq occupation. Because there is an interrelation between the Sunni minority in Iraq and the Sunni majority Wahhabists in Saudi Arabia. This past Sunday, Gary Trudeau had a wonderful, wonderful Doonesbury in which Ray, I think it is, it's Ray, out on a mission trying to train his Iraqi counterpart, and they're going to bust into a safe house and take a Shia militia leader captive or some such. And the Iraqi tells him, I must kill the Sunni scum. And Ray says, well, why is that? He said, one of his family harmed a member of my family. They killed them. And Ray says, really? When did this happen? Where? When? The Iraqi says, 1387. And Ray says, what is it with you people? Well, it's a long memory. It's a long memory, and it's tribalism and clanism. Adherence to clan instead of state or nation. And it is still prevalent in many, many places in the world today. And just because we don't necessarily know who our great-grandfather was doesn't mean they don't. And ancient indignities and ancient injustices are cause for present hatreds. So it is not surprising to see George Bush at a 12% approval rating in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Yeah, this is astonishing stuff. Even the English language newspaper in that tyrannical dictatorship wrote, and it's called the Arab News, a Saudi English language newspaper. They editorialized saying that George Bush's record makes it hard for Arabs to believe that he can deliver on any of his promises. This is the quote: "No Palestinian, no Arab believes he will or can deliver. Everything he touches turns to dust and ashes. Iraq, Afghanistan, maybe now even Iran." Imagine that. The Saudi Arabian people, not the royalty, no, the ordinary Saudi Arabian people, have a better comprehension of George W. Bush than the average American. And we live with the guy. No Palestinian, no Arab believes he will or can deliver. My God, this should be carved whenever it is he shuffles off to meet his maker and leaves this mortal coil. This should be carved on George Bush's tombstone. Everything he touches turns to dust and ashes. Say it with me. Everything he touches turns to dust and ashes. And of course, those ashes, that dust, falls on us. It falls on shattered families receiving the horrifying news of the death of one of their loved ones in Iraq, in Afghanistan. What's the end of that children's nursery rhyme, that children's game? Ashes, ashes, we all fall down. So that's the end of the second hour. You want to get involved with the program, you know the number, 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. Or on your unlimited long-distance dialing plan, 304-658-5453. This is America's liberal voice, America's listener-supported liberal voice. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Say it's true. They got a message from the action man. I'm happy. Hope you're happy too. I've loved all and needed love. Saw the details fall away. The shrieking when nothing is killing. Just pictures of Jeff girls in synthesis. And I ain't got no money. Ashes to ash and fuck to fuck it. We know Major Tom's a junkie. Strung out in heaven's high, hitting that all-time low. Time to begin, I tell myself. I'll stay clean tonight. But the little green wheels are born.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Citigroup workers are holding their breaths today as they anticipate an announcement that could include up to 20,000 layoffs. According to CNBC, the company is expected to announce huge losses today in its fourth quarter earnings. As a result, economists are speculating the company will seek to write down $24 billion and lay off a massive amount of workers in order to cut costs. The Nevada Education Association says its lawsuit against the state Democratic Party over special at-large precincts and casino resorts is not a proxy war between the Obama and Clinton camps. The NEA has not endorsed any candidate. The suit alleges that setting up special at-large precincts in Vegas casino resorts breaks Nevada state law and the federal equal protection clause by giving workers there an unfair advantage over other workers in the upcoming Democratic presidential caucus. The Culinary Workers Union represents hotel casino workers, and it's supporting Barack Obama. The secretary-treasurer of the Culinary Workers says the suit is an effort to disenfranchise people of color. But Terry Hickman, executive director of the Nevada Education Association, says that's not true.
We're not looking to disenfranchise anyone. This is all about fairness and giving everyone opportunity. And we hope that the party will be able to work this out so that everybody will be given an opportunity to participate. We don't think that special caucus sites should be limited to just a few.
The special at-large precincts make it easier for members of the Culinary Workers Union to vote since they can vote where they work rather than having to return to home precincts. The NEA says it's also hard for other workers across the state to participate in the caucuses, and they deserve equal consideration. 15 rank-and-file teachers sent a letter to their union urging the teachers' union to drop this suit. A hearing is set to begin today between Connecticut's largest tribal casino and the United Auto Workers. Jesse Russell reports.
The National Labor Relations Board will begin hearing a case today that will determine the validity of a union election at the Foxwoods Resort Casino in Connecticut. The casino is owned by the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation, which has challenged the results of an election that found a majority of workers seeking representation by the United Auto Workers. The board has thrown out two of the Pequot's 10 objections, including one that contested that the casino, being on tribal land, doesn't fall under the jurisdiction of the NLRB. The remaining objections concern how UAW members went about encouraging workers to vote, suggesting that some workers were harassed into voting for the union. If the board does agree that there was misconduct during the election, then a new election will be held. Only one other tribal casino in the country has workers represented by a union, and Foxwoods would be the first in the state of Connecticut. The hearing is expected to close on Thursday, and decisions usually take 1 or 2 weeks.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Alrighty then. What do you want to take the rest of the night? Or the rest of the show, I should say. There's a lot of night left. In particular, coming your way at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, the world's most fabulous LGBTQQS and S. Yeah, no, there's only one S. Conversation radio program, namely Strictly Confidential, featuring the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio host, Peter Godbold. Also this evening, the horn section coming your way at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, and as usual, all foxed up at midnight Eastern Time, 9 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Sydney, Eastern Australia time. Got the bases covered? Great. I sit back and look, I spend a lot of time doing all this stuff associated with the horn, and frankly, I am I'm guilty of occasionally thinking that neglecting because it is familiar to me, just not sitting back and taking a deep breath and realizing what a miracle. A man-made, human-made miracle this network is.
from the weekly lineup to the weekend lineup of Matt Sowards and Devin Swartz with the Sowards Report, and Billy Shears with Night Sounds, and Rick Goodner with Rick's Place, and the programs that we continue to develop and hope to develop, and all the people who make it go. What an amazing, amazing thing it is. And my many thanks to all of you who pour your blood, your sweat, and your tears into making the horn happen. My God, what an amazing, amazing group you are. And that includes not only the people making the shows go and making the network go, but the people who share their time with us who make it all worthwhile. Thank you. To the phones. Hi, who have I got?
My name is Kurt, and I'm in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Hi, Kurt. How are you? Good to hear from you.
I am been working as an activist since 92, and I've run for Congress several times with the Greens and is an independent. And right now I'm working on something called the Common Sense Revival, which I think is the reason I called, is about solutions. You know, there's a lot of terrible things going on, and we're really in a fascist police state that needs to be dealt with, and it has to be done rationally, and it has to be done by people who have courage. Now, have you ever heard of critical thinking at all? Or I'm sure you've heard the word, but it's a movement about education, and it's about citizen empowerment, because we all have to think clearly. And then there's something that we're also working with, which is positive psychology. So the idea is to have people think as clearly as they can, and everybody should be studying as much as they can about what's going on, and try to be positive, because we are faced with, you know, as you become more clear about the issues, you're going to become depressed and not to get bogged down or self-destructive, you know. So anyway, I guess what we're proposing is, you know, like a fireman wants to put out a fire at the base of the flames, we have a bunch of people who are not very clear in their thinking because our school systems produce sheeple, and that's why the dictators, whatever you want to call them, that run our country and our world are so successful. People are not confident in their ability to solve anything. And to me, it seems that the answers are right here on the shelf. They just have to be enacted by a vibrant citizenry. So,
I'm in agreement with everything you've just said, Kurt. The question that is begged by all that you have said, however, is the how part.
Well, it takes courage. People who really believe in themselves and they believe in hope of the future, or for the future, actually do something. Now, I spent, for example, 10 years on the street, the square of Scranton, Pennsylvania, with a bunch of signs that I carted down on a bicycle and would kind of do battle or would persuade or try to just be a public citizen. And I think that's part of it. You know, when you interact with people, pitch something progressive. Pitch some analysis that you have backed up with some clear evidence, and take that out wherever you are. I mean, I think that people should make signs and take it to the square whenever they can. I think they should, you know, it's more than sending an email to one another.
Oh,
it's kind of anonymous. I mean, to do something public or to engage, say, even members of your family who disagree with you.
Or, well, and when you appear in public, you empower the people who have up until that time been afraid to do so themselves, right?
Well, exactly. I work as a DJ, for example, and it only takes two or three people to make a dance floor happen. In the same way, I believe, with activists, when there's one facilitator or focalizer on the square, for example, it empowers so many people, and it is that kind of kinetic phenomena of having someone have the confidence to do something that kicks off a chain reaction of other people.
Anybody who's ever been to a seventh grade dance knows exactly what you're talking about, because all the kids are around the side walls, the lights are dim, and maybe the disco balls go on, the music's thumping out, and nobody and everybody's afraid of looking like a fool if they get out and dance. But two people do, and from 2 to 20 is a pretty quick leap.
I think we're all terrified of ourselves in some ways, or of being free in front of other people. And if there's three people who feel free and empowered, they can make a whole room go crazy. With, you know, so I guess we just have to believe in that sort of physical power of making a gesture, right? I mean, it's basically what we're doing here is making a gesture. We don't know if anything's going to really happen from our work, although I believe that the stuff that's in our hands will shape the next 1,000 years, if we actually have 1,000 years to work with. But, you know, this is a very key time for us. We shouldn't be bumming out, you know. We should be so excited that opportunities for progressive ideas have never been more fertile, you know. A lot of regular people who, you know, aren't the usual suspects here, regular people are on board now to find out. Did you ever study the Federal Reserve, by the way, just as an aside?
Yes.
Yeah, because I've just been concerned about, you know, because the Fed is talking about the interest rates and this and that, that we are kind of trapped in a matrix of finance that, you know, ebbs and flows, and they manipulate the currency flow, and it, you know, you let someone have a bunch of credit, they're going to run off and get in debt, which is kind of a natural human condition, apparently, and then they jerk it all back and take everybody's stuff. The Fed is, Ben Bernanke has admitted that they caused the Great Depression, the Fed did, through a bunch of research. So anyway, I'm just saying that we're
Kurt, let me ask you, where do you direct these energies? Is there a particular issue that you're on top of that you feel like is the linchpin issue, or is it?
I think that when I ran for Congress, my slogan was "Give every child a chance." So if we have a critical thinking based education system for every child, or we have a bunch of citizens doing the critical thinking with young people, or promoting these ideas, because it's basically a vocabulary of analysis. What are my assumptions, and such like that. So I believe that first we have to think clearly about what's going on, because there are literally 1,000 issues on our plate. So I don't particularly, you know, I think there's a lot of issues. I could talk at length about them, but some are more crucial than others. But I think that giving every child an opportunity to fulfill their genetic potential, and then looking at what I think is the primary conspiracy here, is that to give poor children bad school systems, or school systems that reinforce a kind of memorization, factory worker mentality. And there's this cascade, you know, the rich kids get rich kids schools, they get to become the managers or whatever, the specialists. So that's how can everyone be free in America if only some of them are getting properly educated? So that's, to me, something we have to work on in all our communities, because it's all based on property tax and property value.
So, but you are an advocate for the public. You do believe in the public education system.
I just think it shouldn't be based on property values. Or if it is property values, it'd be at least at a state level.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. It should be an aggregated function of state property values, not individual countywide property values, where a kid in County A goes to a crappy school, but a kid in County B, where there's more money, goes to a better school. And I don't mean that we should drive the better school down to the crappy school. We should be working on lifting the crappy school up. And we're certainly not doing that under No Child's Behind Left, because that's a system and a process that was designed to destroy the public school system. That's why I asked you initially, if you do favor public education. Because, you know, this ask any libertarian, ask any Republican. It's been a plank of theirs for years, every 4 years, the abolition of the United States Department of Education.
Well, they want to create that. That's part of their sheeple plan. You know, the masters or whatever, the oligarchs, you cannot have a critical thinking citizenry and have a master class. And the polarization of our income and the wealth in this country is deliberate. And it's only done, I think, because we don't have real serious efforts for public education. You know, I remember reading the Wall Street Journal back in the 90s, and of all the surveyed economists, the only thing they could come up with that they agreed on was investment in education. Because literally, this is the genetic potential of our society being thrown in the garbage. And I don't, you know, this is 2008. I cannot believe. I went to California for a conference on critical thinking in 92 and fought tooth and nail, you know, and I live in a very, what I call, third world region of America, and the coal mines and the oppression, you know, we built the labor market here, but it's long gone. Everyone here is shattered, and I'm sure that's that way all over America, and you know, we need to take heart. We are the most powerful human beings that ever lived, and grasp the reins of power in this country somehow. I mean,
well, America's genius in the past has always been incubated by people who were not necessarily of the landed gentry or the wealthy elite, rising up beyond their station and doing something that was motivated by the place from whence they came. I'm in absolute agreement with you, Kurt.
Well, I mean, all I can say is that we have to believe in ourselves. The time is now, and the website is commonsenserevival.tripod.com. What it is actually a chautauqua. Have you ever heard of a chautauqua?
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100 years ago, it was the largest public education movement in America. The first book clubs were chautauquas. So it's kind of a place. It was a traveling, I guess, medicine show, or part vaudeville, part debate society. And these festivals that go on in America, we're going to try to go out and disseminate this information and just rebuild America, a renaissance of democracy, we're calling it.
Now, you know that, and I love the idea. I absolutely love the idea. But you do, I mean, you know that you're fighting an uphill struggle.
I think we're, you know, I don't favor body surf, but, you know, you have to sort of anticipate the wave, and the wave is coming. People are frustrated, and when this wave of bankruptcies and mortgage foreclosures goes through, these people are going to be frustrated, and we want to get in front of this, what could be a terrible destructive wave. They want something bad to happen so they can tighten the reins of their fascism. So we don't want that to happen. We want people to react rationally and not, you know, out of pressure or violence or rage, because that's exactly what they want. So, it might be an uphill battle in some ways, but nothing more powerful than an idea.
Well, I'm not trying to be negative. I'm just trying to think about the forces. You know, anybody who's ever read, for instance, Sun Tzu, you know, The Art of War. You've got to be cognizant of the forces arrayed against you. How do you push for something like critical thinking when arrayed against you are a cadre of people who insist on telling children that the world is just slightly younger than the recipe for beer or writing?
Well, the churches have been allowed to just, you know, I don't know if, you know, you have to be ginger about how you handle churches, but I've actually protested in front of the cathedral. So I guess what I'm saying is people who are irrational should not be allowed to get away with it. So
you confront them straight up?
Straight up. And that was one of my first issues, was actually the abortion issue, and stating that we can reduce the number of unplanned pregnancies, and I always felt that the pro-choice community should have went right out and addressed that and tried to reduce the number of pregnancies and do something what I call rational sexuality, which they never did. So now this abortion issue has gone on and on and on, and that's just an example of how if you confront people who say they don't believe in abortions but they don't believe in birth control, well, they shouldn't be allowed to be part of the conversation then. You know,
hallelujah to you, Kurt. I tell you, I've been waiting a long time for somebody to say that, because I've been saying it too. When you make a statement of fact and somebody comes up to you and says, "Oh, but," and then unleashes a bunch of mythology at you, you just look at him and go, "You know, you're nuts. You're not part of this conversation. We're looking for a solution here, and you're not going to be part of the solution. So go prattle somewhere else."
Well, what I say is, if you want to have a worldview that's 2,000 years old, that's your right. But I want you to stop using technology right now. Hang up the phone. Turn off the TV. Stop driving your car. Because if you're going to live in a scientific and technological world, you have to accept kind of how we got here. They don't even understand the technology they use, and yet we're the most anti-scientific. There's numbers of people that are running for president that do not believe in evolution. And, most people don't believe in evolution because we haven't done a very good job of at least teaching some of the concepts. You know, we need to create our children as little scientists, because this is a world based on science in a lot of ways. You know, that's not taking God out of it, but I think God created science. God created all this stuff. So, you know, again, we have, I think, the religion is kind of dead in some ways. And, you know, it's like a snake with its head cut off. It's writhing around and trying to still affect things. But most of the world is secular. Most of, you know, if you look at Europe, which is a more modern society, you know, only about 10% of the people even go to church, and they're all elderly. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Science is one, and it's been a long... Since they created the electric light, I think religion's been on the run. You know? So it's just a long process. I think it's time now for rational people, again, in a nice way, go and I think we should actually go and protest. And I believe in real shame. You know, shame works. And sadly, that's all we have is shame. You know, and if you go stand in front of one of those crazy right-wing churches, these mega churches, for example, and carry signs that who would Jesus bomb, for example, or other issues which they are totally vulnerable to, these are like, they believe in killing, apparently. Some people. For some reason.
The largest single Protestant denomination in the United States was an open advocate for the slaughter of the Iraqi people, Kurt. Yes, the Southern Baptist Convention.
Call them on this. Enough already. They can't get away with this. I don't believe that. And if you have a very clear moral stance, then you should, you know, to take their own words, you're armored with the breastplate of righteousness. Now, if you have one good idea, now for me, for example, I read in the Wall Street Journal that the Republicans wanted to make it easier, you know, with the Newt Gingrich and the contract on America, they wanted to make it easier to sell tobacco to children. They wanted to cut the funding for sales of tobacco to minors laws. Now, I was a child smoker. I was still smoking cigarettes at the time. And I said, well, here we have it. This is the Just Say No people trying to make it easier to sell cigarettes. Now, this is 1995, when Joe Camel was still all over the place.
Right.
So I made a sign that said, Joe Camel is a child molester. And the other side said, Republicans work for drug dealers. That is evil. And that was just one of the signs that I kept on going. And, you know, I'm just saying over and over, we can create our own signs and go out in our own squares, have our own conversations around the water cooler, and be a force for change and not be, just whining, but offer a solution. If you're going to complain about something, have a solution at the ready so people don't just think you're a whiner. You know what I'm saying? It's just,
yeah.
It's kind of a strategy that we have to have. Scott Ritter, I think, just wrote a book about the peace movement and how they have to be more aggressive in some ways. That's one of the reasons I think that the traditional liberals that I've always talked with are, they'll use the word namby-pambies, you know.
Well, that's, you're talking, Kurt, you're talking a lot about the very reason that this network exists. Is to
go head on.
to go head on, to brace people, to empower people to stand up to these thugs. Because a lot of their tactics are outright thuggery.
Well, they're bullies, and I think, just like any other bully, when they're confronted, they run. They only work in packs, and they work with terror. They're literally terrorists. And, you know, again, to do this type of thing, you have to admit that it might be scary and dangerous. I've been in prison for my work and, just for free speech. In fact, I type Kurt Schatko into Google and you'll see all the nonsense that's gone on over the years up here. And I just think that you have to accept that might happen, and then you have a soul force because now you're free. You don't have to worry anymore. I accept that it might be scary to do this, and I accept that I might get arrested sometimes.
But it's But tell me, Kurt, when you get right down to it, isn't it a lot like a trip to the dentist? It's more scary going than it is being there?
Yeah, and at the end, you're actually done something positive. And I'll tell you, you want a cure for depression or whatever else that goes on, go and do something vital, like carry a sign on a street corner and interact with people and have a real human experience. You've actually done something instead of just sent an email and complained. You went and did something. You're going to be so excited that you'll keep doing it again and again. And that's what we have to do, is create events that people can go and participate in, where they get that excitement where, you know, and however you facilitate those things, whether it's a kind of parade around your town or, I mean, vigils, something that people can
participate in. Sign in the yard, yeah.
Create something. A sign-making party. Have potlucks where you show some of these great films that are going around about what's going on. Please, everybody, just get educated, and because now is the time, you know, how much power we have as educated progressives. So,
well, we're ahead of the curve by virtue of that education, Kurt, and by virtue of the progressive nature of our thinking.
We're right. We've been right for a long time, and I say to these thugs and whatever, they're going into the dustbin of history. People for generations hence will curse their name, and you just say, listen, you guys are, you know, you might have been mistaken, you might have been hoodwinked, but enough already. Give it up. Let's clean up this country, and we have to start with some of the financial system, because that's the core of whether a job is going to be there or your house or whatever. So the Federal Reserve, I think, needs to be phased out, and that's another conversation. But even if the financial system completely collapses, there's always the barter system. We could live without a central bank. We could live without any bank, for that matter. So, I mean, even, you know, if there is an impending financial collapse, that's a bunch of nonsense. What we need to do is provide services and work together, and there's already a structure for that. And the alternative fuel, you know, there's so much things we could do. Soft Energy Paths by Amory Lovins is an important book you should all look at in terms of studying our energy economy.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of it?
No, I haven't. Soft Energy Paths?
Soft Energy Paths. Well, he talks about it as these power grids, for example, are a great security risk, you know, but it goes back to the command and control that is at the heart of what goes on in this country,
and that's at the heart of why it's so difficult to get off the grid.
Yeah, we're trapped in a grid, and he wrote that book some years ago. Amory Lovins has the Rocky Mountain Institute. He's been winning a lot of prizes lately for his work, but he's a brilliant man, and check him out. But anyway, that's just part of what's going on, and it goes back to taking courage and getting your facts straight and having maybe an arsenal of comebacks for people, because I think fewer and fewer people are going to be so snippy as they have been in the past, but, you know, they're ready to be convinced that there's a better way.
Some are.
I think more than you might even suspect, and even if you have an interaction where I call it belly bucking, you know, they have to have a sort of aggressive thing, and they yell at you a little bit.
Yeah.
But they go away and they think about what you said to them, and it might sit in their craw for, it might take years, actually. Some people are tough, but, you know, it's better to plant that seed that they have to think about whether you were right or not.
Exactly, and again, framing things in such a way that they can comprehend it and can agree with it. We've been shown time and again, Kurt, that the framing issue is critical to how we talk about issues in America, whether it's health care or whether it's starting foreign wars or how we view working people in this country. It's absolutely imperative that we stop working within the language that has been set up for us, because that's just walking through a floor full of bear traps.
Yeah, the Republicans certainly did a better job at the framing, and I watched, you know, Newt Gingrich. They would circulate a list of words, you know.
Yeah, the infamous Gingrich word list.
And, you know, that's pretty despicable, and the left is not capable of that, and it, as its core value, is not like that. But we do need to, all of us, think about how we... Now, when I talk about national health, I say, you know, a la Michael Moore, actually... Why should we demand a profit from something that's an essential service, just like fire and police?
Precisely.
And I start saying, you know, well, the goddamn fire department is not turning a profit here. You know, well, that sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But that's just one example. When we talk to our people and say, you know, we have, again, back to facts, we have infant mortality rate. When you talk to a pro-life person, which I don't use that term.
I know, yeah.
An anti-choice person, you say, you know, our infant mortality rate is like 20-something in the world. What's going on here, and why is that?
Yeah, and you postpartum know? Maternal mortality, the same thing.
It's despicable. And we're the richest country ever, but, you know, anyway, they're... But
there's money to be had in it, so we'll tolerate it.
Well, enough with the money. It's time for the care. And I think it ultimately, when you like try to figure out why some people would value stuff over people or whatever, and that's at the core of what... The American problem is, apparently, we would rather have a McMansion with several sport utility vehicles and some quads and a ski-doo, and go on and on and on. That's our values. That's what we want, rather than have...
Because we have it broken over our heads hour upon hour, minute by minute, every blessed day, Kurt. And the thing that strikes me here is, you know, you began the conversation talking about critical thinking. Obviously, linguistically, the word critical modifies thinking, right?
Yeah.
Well, and so I think maybe the ground level analysis that we're working toward here is that you've got to get them thinking before you can get them to do it critically, because there is a whole lot of America that isn't even bothering to think.
Well, you know, when the beer is gone and the TV is shut off, and that's the parameter that we're heading towards. When there's no more beer and there's no more TV, they're going to have to start thinking. The game's over, you know, and they're going to have to wake up and smell the coffee or whatever. So I think that let's anticipate that there will be thinking going on. It might not be all that critical, or it might be critical, but it might not be very accurate. So.
Well, let me throw this one at you though too. I don't know how long you've been listening to the program or listening to the network.
Just recently, I got it on the internet, and
well, I'm awfully glad to hear from you. I hope we'll hear from you more often. Let me throw this one at you, Kurt. The word thinking, I don't think that a lot of America knows what that word means anymore.
They confuse it with feeling.
Precisely. I have frequently said that the most loathsome word in the English language by my lights is believe. Because, let me give you an example of it. You'll love this. You know, George Bush went over and had a hysterical crying fit in Israel last week, right? And he...
Very embarrassing what was going on over there. Go ahead.
I know.
Yeah.
So a senior official who spoke only on condition of anonymity quoted George Bush thusly in conversations with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. This is the quote. It's from a Newsweek story. He told the Israelis that he can't control what they're talking about the national intelligence estimate that said, you know, Iran hasn't had a nuclear weapons program since 2003 and shows no sign of trying to develop one. You know the backstory.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay. This is the quote. He told the Israelis that he can't control what the intelligence community says, but that the NIE's conclusions don't reflect his own views about Iran's nuclear weapons program, said the official. And see, that's the thing. Don't reflect his own views. Now, I saw a story from an Israeli newspaper that reported it as, don't reflect his own beliefs about Iran's nuclear weapons program. It's the Tinkerbellization of American discourse and American cogitation, if you will. We have made this wholesale mistaken shift, Kurt, between what we think, what we know, and on the other hand, what we believe. For instance, George Bush doesn't like the national intelligence estimate that tells him he doesn't have a good reason to blow the snot out of Iran, so therefore he just won't believe it. You see what I'm getting at?
That's deliberate. It has been going on for a long time, and I think that they have, they being the people that want us to be trapped in a subjective world where we're not really sure of what's going on, and we don't really have the analytical skill to do anything about it. So that's been a deliberate process, I'd say since the 60s. The 60s created a real wake-up call for the power structure, and they deliberately, since that point, have been trying to turn us into a bunch of bliss ninnies, is what I call them. You know, people just kind of lost in...
Oh, that's a great one. Bliss ninnies?
Bliss ninnies, yeah.
I'm stealing that one, Kurt.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. They're so, and sometimes they're kind of new agey, and they could be on the left, and sometimes they're right-wing Bible-thumping bliss ninnies. And, you know, but again, it goes back to, and here's how, again, I frame it. I say, my God wants me to be as smart as possible. So I'm open to learning about things, and I can't sort of...
Yeah, unless I misremember it, Kurt, there's some verse somewhere in Proverbs, I think it is, that says, I don't know, maybe it's Psalms, flip-floppians, I can't remember, but it says, study to show thyself approved?
Yes. By their fruits you shall know them is another one. But what are the fruits of our current faithful people? You know, it's endless war and a military-industrial complex.
Death, destruction, misery. Yeah, that all comes home to roost in the right-wing religion industry.
So, So these guys are vulnerable, and they're all over the country, these right-wing zealots. And have you ever heard of Chris Hedges? Hitchens. No, Hedges.
I read Chris Hedges and Christopher Hitchens and his God Is Not Great book.
Yeah.
I know both, yeah.
Well, Hedges has really talked very articulately about these Dominionists, and they're a subset of the evangelical movement, and they're proto-fascists or fascists in their nature.
We talk a lot about the Dominionists. Let me take you to another step, and I think Chris Hedges has also spoken to this and written about this as well. The Dominionists seem mild by comparison with another proto-fascist subset of evangelicism, and those are the Christian Reconstructionists. You ever heard of them?
Yep. I don't know. I couldn't tell you the sub-definition between those two, but
the Reconstructionists will make you sit bolt upright in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning with a sweat rolling off your head once you learn what they're up to.
Have you seen Jesus Camp yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's
the kind of movies that we should show others. And you know, when they brought out that cardboard cutout of George Bush
and prayed to it, yeah, oh,
and set the kids off into this like crying, you know. But again, when you don't have rational progress as your belief base, you're going to go from gambling epidemic to, you know, some craziness over football to, you know, you go from one madness to another.
Hey, didn't our Congress have, you know? And, you know, I promised I'd be as hard or harder on the Democratic-controlled Congress than I ever was on the Republicans. Didn't these idiots have hearings on steroids in baseball today?
In fact, I clicked on C-SPAN, you know, as I clicked through the different media on iTunes, and they were talking again about sports and baseball, and you know, the question was, why didn't you start mandatory testing a long time ago? Like, you didn't know that these guys were doping. But, you know, enough with the sports. I think that that's yet another place. If you look at the sub-agenda of sports, it's to take this male attention, or female attention for that matter, and take it when they should be forming it, learning about the problems of democracy, and they're worried about the problems on the playing field.
Classic case, Kurt. Look at NASCAR. Now,
a physical sport, just an addiction.
Well, on the surface of it, though, you'd think that this is something that would appeal to the guys who, you know, shade tree mechanic their cars and worry about cylinder compression ratios and things like that.
Now you have to do your chips and your electronic testing, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but true. All too true. But look what they did. They turned it into a soap opera about the personalities.
Wrestling on wheels?
Well, professional wrestling on wheels, but they also, they soap operaized it so that they drew in, I mean, my God, fully half of the NASCAR devotees are female.
Well, they knew that they had, you know, they're standing right next to their man, ready to flash, and, you know, I mean, I like
and
to
that's And that's, not me, else, go- that's you know? Not me gooning on women, Kurt. Please understand, it's not.
No, it's just part of the culture. Listen, I think that these people need a good time, but when you mix a good time with this kind of insanity of competition, which I don't know why you have to go and watch an event where people are racing to beat each other and there's all that venom that goes on with it and the gambling that goes right behind there. So, I mean, is some way if we can deaccelerate competition while still keeping the good times? I don't know if people can somehow be persuaded that we don't have to have, you know, Marlboro versus Budweiser racing down the, you know, everybody's waiting for the car wreck. So let's be honest, that's what it's about.
You go for the wrecks, sure.
You know, if it's not the endless drunken infield and the, you know, which corporation you want to root to win, they can wear their logo all over yourself. I mean, but this is a brainwashed, have you seen Idiocracy yet?
God, I love that film.
Well, these are the kind of things, again, just going back.
Go away, I'm baiting.
Go away. But I love how there's like Starbucks and a massage parlor all mixed together. But, you know, that's a film that you could show to your friends in your house and have a discussion. And even if there's young people present, you can have an after discussion. That's where critical thinking comes in, where it's not just watching the media, it's what is your analysis of it. But why would they place the story here? You know, maybe you could, again, if you're around young people, show them a story from a couple different angles. Maybe, you know, here's the Guardian's coverage of the same thing. So it's a way to teach kids Because, I mean, if you want a soap opera, the whole world is like the most unending, insane soap opera.
Well, I'll tell you what, Kurt, if you stay with the network and continue to listen to the programming, I think you're gonna feel right at home, because you're talking about a lot of the stuff that is the daily fare of what goes on the horn, whether it's Guy James or Mark Levine, me, Peter Godbold, or John Fox, or the weekend shows, Matt Sowards, Dr. Rick. The Night Sounds is a nice chance to just sort of kick back and listen to a little music and do that separation and relaxation and enjoyment for a little bit too.
I like music a lot. I'm a DJ. Your name is Peter again, right?
No, I'm Bob.
Bob, I'm sorry, Bob. I apologize.
No, don't worry about it. Peter's coming up next.
Okay, well, Bob, thank you so much for your time today. And you know, the AM radio is doing the same thing. There's a lot of right wing goofs out there. You can call in the AM radio. Just everybody listening. And agitate them with your progressive analysis, because all we need to do is stir the pot a little, and it's all going to happen for us.
All right. Well, thank you, Kurt, and I hope we'll hear from you again.
Talk again, Bob.
Bye now.
Enjoy.
Wow, that was fun. And let me, in the course of the conversation with Kurt, I referenced this this article about George Bush and his private conversations with Ehud Olmert in Israel. And I know that I reference on a lot of occasions the number of things that make me sit bolt upright at 3 o'clock in the morning with a sweat rolling down my head. But there are a lot of things that do, okay? I don't know if it's sleep apnea or if it's just blind terror in the middle of my night that just... And you wake up and you're like... Wow! But this is one of them. Israeli and other foreign officials asked Bush to explain the National Intelligence Estimate, big dependent clause, and George said that he believes Iran remains a threat. Clap loud, everybody, and Tinkerbell won't die. You know, the evil Tinkerbell. Ahmadinejad Tinkerbell, and the terror will stay real. Oh, fly, Falkor, fly! The nothing is behind us. Is there a better analogy than the never-ending story for George W. Bush? We're being threatened by the nothing. To take the words of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Yeah, and that nothing's a hell of a lot, and it's coming to get us, and it hates us for our freedoms, the nothing. Critical thinking. Critical thinking. Well, not a lot of critical thinking going on in the Nevada Supreme Court this evening. I've recently received word that the Nevada Supreme Court stepped in to overrule the judge who said that Dennis Kucinich must be included in the debate in Nevada. He stepped in on the side of big media and big message and big idea control and told MSNBC they were completely within their right to exclude a mainstream presidential candidate because, you know, Dennis doesn't have any ideas worth discussing. We started out this program this evening, me and that mouse in my pocket. Nah, you and I, you know. Started out this program tonight talking about the court system in West Virginia. And we moved on to the Supreme Court of the United States. And now we find somehow or another we've managed to come full circle, almost, to another corrupt court in, okay, geography moment, quick, capital of Nevada, Carson City! Another corrupt court, this one sitting in Carson City, Nevada. What in the hell's wrong with a different idea? I remember way back when, as a kid, the advertising slogan of the Ford Motor Company was a clicking on of a light bulb where the O in Ford was, and it said, "At Ford, we've got a better idea." Better idea, don't let the sun set on you here. We don't want any better ideas. We want the same old, tired, worn-out BS that we've been handed every 4 years since God was a baby. Oh, we need family values. Yeah, there's a couple of minutes left in the program, and I'm damn sure not going to let them slide by without mentioning this. Speaking of tired, worn-out, crappy ideas, our buddy, the Reverend Mike Huxterby, not former Governor Mike Huxterby, but the current Reverend Mike Huxterby, wants to amend the... Oh, sit down, everybody, because this stuff, you know, it is easy to get sucked up by the nothing or get hauled into the negative. Because you hear this kind of stuff and you know that there's a room full of people going, yay, praise Jesus! Mike Huxterby says he wants to amend the Constitution to God's standards.
But I believe it's a lot easier to change the Constitution than it would be to change the Word of the living God. And that's what we need to do, is to amend the Constitution so it's in God's standards rather than try to change God's standards so it lines up with some contemporary view of how we treat each other and how we treat the family.
Did you hear them roaring their approval? Do you have a sense for what we are up against? Amend the Constitution so it's in God's standards. In other words, up until now, we have had a godless atheist Constitution, and it needs to be made holy. You tell me, what is the difference between Mike Huckabee and some radical Islamist cleric in the Middle East? What is the difference? Because if you can find the difference, you are a hell of a lot better than I am, because I can't. Mike Huckabee is an Ayatollah, all right? Mike Huckabee is a radical fundamentalist cleric, but I'll be damned if we can find anybody out there who will set that frame up and make him wear it. Reverend Huckabee, what would you say to someone who says that you are a radical fundamentalist cleric? Well, I mean, you're a gospel sharp, right? So you are a cleric. Well, and you are a member of a fundamentalist faith. And what you're preaching's pretty radical, amending the Constitution to put God into it, isn't it? That's radical fundamentalist cleric, and ding, 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 ding. You're it, Mike! Amend the Constitution to God's standards. God's standards, of course, don't include people being able to marry whom they love. They don't include women being able to make decisions about the goings-on inside their own bodies. That needs to be made for the stupid, godless women by an upstanding, godly male, just like it is in the Good Book. Get ready for it, because you know what? I'd give that man 50-50 odds right now that he's your next president. Hunker down. Hunker down. Thanks, everybody, for joining in the chat room via email, by telephone, and by just sitting there by the computer and screaming sometimes. God knows I do. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thanks to Peter Godbold, our IT professional. Thanks to John Fox, our engineer, webmaster, and all-around fixer of things that go crunk. Thanks to Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk, whiterosesociety.org. When there was hardly any liberal talk in America, there was Ben Birch making sure that that what was there was available. Many, many continued thanks to the hard-working, dedicated people of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. If you haven't joined, join. It's cheap, and you won't do a better thing for less money anytime soon. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Kids, it's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
America and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 101, Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network. I just lost my spot. Hey, you know what it was? It was Bob Kincaid. I've got to tell you, I've got to stop listening to his show. He actually thanked John Fox for fixing all things that go crunk. That was about all I could take. I was laughing out loud, trying to find headphones, trying to find my glasses. And Bob says something like that. It's not safe to listen to a Bob Kincaid's show and then go into your own. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Tuesday, January the 15th, 2008. So if you're listening a little after 9 p.m. on a Tuesday,
which is January the 15th, you are indeed listening to a live show. And you're welcome to call in and speak to myself and to the guest I'll be introducing shortly. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on. That's 877-443-2366 to get it out numerically. If you have unlimited long distance, please use that and save the studio a nickel or a buck. And every bit helps. As I said, we are listener-supported. By the way, you'll find the PayPal buttons if you can help keep the network streaming and passing packets. That's at headonradionetwork.com. You'll find the PayPal button on the homepage there, in addition to a thousand other things. The studio line for a unlimited long distance is area code 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check that during the breaks. Let's see what we have here. The show site, yes, it's strictlyconfidentialradio.com. There you're going to find links to all of the guests. You'll find links to the audio archives from past shows, as well as to our chat room, which is active as we speak. You'll find links to the Head On Radio Network main site, and there you can find out about all the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network. There are links there also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. Speaking of the music that we hear on the show, we have a wonderful treat for you this evening in the last half hour of the show. Tonight's DJ over at the gay bar across the street, Rumors, is VJC. That's Victor from Disco 935. He has a great set of music. Larry will be with us tomorrow, Larry Sanders. VJC again Thursday. And the Friday of this week, we have Bobby Vittoretti. Coming up Monday, it will be Mr. Alex Natikin with actually DJ Martin Verlan is playing the